My name is Guido Garaycochea. I am 59 years old. Today is Saturday, September the 4th, 2021. I am in New London, Connecticut with my friend, Mike Alowitz.
And my name is Mike Alowitz. I am very old. I'm 70 years old. And today's date is also incredibly Saturday, September 4th, 2021. I am in New London, Connecticut, in the belly of the beast, and I'm here chatting with Guido, and he's a fellow artist and someone that I very much respect in his artwork.
Well, see, likewise. That's why
you said nothing.
I love you. That's why I love you.
Said nothing nice about me.
Well, I have
but,
only wonderful
so
things
much,
to talk.
So much for the Latin American, you know, being real polite and everything. All right, Guido, we'll remember this. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mike.
Now,
Mike.
Now try to say
I prepare. Well, you prepare those questions, and I am ready to ask you okay. about something that we have discussed many times before, and about censorship and that. What is that about? That you are the most censored artist in the United States?
Well, actually, as far as I know, I'm the most censored artist in the world, and of course, no one has ever heard of me. I'm so censored that I'm not even in censored books. But almost all of the work, I do agitprop murals, and I've had my work destroyed by governments, by union officials, by political parties, during strikes and struggles, a lot of international stuff that I've created in Central America, Nicaragua, in the occupied territories, in Northern Ireland, the places that I go to paint, South Central, LA, a lot of my work has been destroyed, almost all of it, and yet you never hear a word about it. And the reason that you never hear about it is because I don't do work that uses workers simply as subject matter, but I create murals with workers that relate to the social struggles that they're engaged in. Strikes and struggles, the anti-war movement, solidarity movements, things like that. And so when you do this kind of work, agitprop, which is a combination of the words agitation and propaganda, you become as invisible in the art world as workers are invisible in mainstream culture. In our mainstream culture, I painted a mural in Chernobyl, for example, and kids came to me and they said, because they had started getting North American TV, they said, does anyone in America work? They were very serious in this question, because when you watch television, you see people in nice apartments in New York having fun. You see cops, you see rich lawyers, but you don't ever see a worker. And so they legitimately wanted to know, are there any workers? And there aren't. We have no images of workers. And so the people who feed us, the people who clothe us, the people who build our shelters, the maintenance people who keep our buildings clean and prevent us from getting sick, who serve us safe food, all of these people are very invisible. And so when you become part of their artistic expression, you become invisible too. And that's why my projects are very theatrical. I get a lot of press about them in the mainstream press. You know, there's articles in the New York Times maybe, or the Washington Post or whatever, but never a mention in any of the art press. There's not an inch about Mike Alowitz anywhere. And I'm not the only one, but as far as I know, I'm the most frequently painted mural painter that's been censored.
Tell me something that I really haven't heard from your experience in the occupied territory. And that's interesting to me. I mean, you being an artist, So how was that experience and how long it was and what happened?
Well, I painted several pieces this in the occupied territories. Having a Jewish heritage, I could easily fly into Israel, although I had to get through a lot of red tape. The way we put these projects together is we have to create very broad coalitions to sponsor it. So we get a lot of unions, start with individual local unions. We build up, we try to get a few celebrities, people like that. So when I go to paint, it's clear that there are broad forces involved in it. Then when I got to the occupied territories, had to meet with Palestinian unions, had to, because it's an apartheid state, so you have separate unions, had to meet with also Israeli unions, try to get as broad a coalition together as possible, because people take these things very seriously. And if you don't want to get shot or something, you want to make sure you have your base covered. We ended up meeting at the time with Yasser Arafat, who was head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. He says, it's okay, we got all these unions. They say, it's okay. Everybody says, it's okay, go out and paint murals. So I painted a mural in the Beit Jabrin refugee camp. I painted a project with Palestinian construction workers who are being replaced by other immigrant construction workers within the state of Israel. Most of the construction is done by Palestinians who don't have the same rights as Israelis. I did a mural at the Rachel Corey Peace Center, which Rachel Corey was a student from Washington State, Evergreen State College, and she was murdered by the Israeli Defense Forces for opposing housing demolitions. And that one was immediately knocked down by the Israeli army came and knocked the building down that I'd painted the mural on. So these projects are very broad in their sponsorship. And the idea really behind them isn't so much that me painting a mural is going to mean a lot in terms of, because there are plenty of artists there creating work. And I don't do it in a Banksy way that is designed to promote myself. But the importance of it is, we had a labor delegation that came along. We went, we were able to talk about and learn about housing demolitions, these kinds of things, the state of apartheid, how it works, come back and express that to people, give forums, publicize it, things like that. And that's kind of typical of the kind of thing that I've been doing over the past couple of decades.
Yeah, because you have been to Central America, Mexico, etc.
Same thing. You know, when I went to Northern Ireland right after that, same thing. The idea was to paint a mural that would inject the idea of Protestant and Catholic workers uniting together against their employers instead of fighting each other. And I painted a mural about Malcolm X, who was a nationalist but also an internationalist, and it's kind of symbolized that. But as soon as I left, they destroyed that mural was destroyed too.
Where was that?
That was in Belfast. And it was in a part of Belfast, the Ardoyne, which was the center of what they called the Troubles. And a lot of people were getting killed. I mean, their bomb went off when we were there, and there was shooting at some of the artists' homes and stuff. And again, we had to set it up the same way, so that we had church involved and all this kind of stuff to protect both myself and the other artists who are involved, more the other artists than me. When you're a North American artist, even someone who's denigrated like myself, you're less likely to get shot than if you're a local artist. You know, same thing when we went to Chernobyl, same thing. You know, so a lot of these projects are... The idea is to use the art as a weapon, to use it as a way to really inject yourself into the social struggles that are going on, and to use it to give visual expression to these very important social struggles that thousands of people are involved in. I'm just one artist, so, but it shows what a unique contribution artists can make, because people can use it as a focal point to rally around or use it as a tool to.
Yeah, yes, the making of the murals, yes, is a way of concentrated energy and force and exchange of ideas.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I worked when I work in these places, you know, I have a picture over here, and it's I'm in Baghdad between the wars, and I'm painting, and there's hundreds of kids, and we're having slideshows, we're exchanging ideas. This is when Saddam Hussein was still in power, and you're building an organic solidarity. All the places I've gone in the world that are basically the U.S. is trying to strangle. And there's every reason for the people to hate the United States. And they do hate the United States government.
Not you.
Not me. They love me because I'm part of their struggle. I'm against the United States. What's the United States government doing?
This difference that people knows between the people of the United States and the United States as a imperialist monster.
Yes. No, I am just treated so nicely when I go places. Just so wonderfully, because exactly what you're saying, people know the difference. And they know that we're fighting against these policies in the United States. You know, I was in Cuba, and some of the people who were part of the delegation, there was a big mobilization because there were some war provocations at the time by the U.S. And there were these big mobilizations. I went down to join the demonstrations, and they said, well, weren't you worried? Because it's against the U.S. Worried. I felt so much at home for the first time. I was out demonstrating against the government. This is what I do. And no, everybody gets that. People, there's no troubles between artists in the world. There's no trouble between artists. There's only joy and collaboration. I'm usually around musicians in these places. You know, people are all playing music, and it's the trouble is between governments that represent capitalist interests.
Yeah, the power. Yeah, the power.
That's where the problem is. The idea that artists in Iraq, when I painted in Iraq,
even the idea of countries is so artificial, and it's a construction, yes, that we have done just to divide us.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're just lines.
Yeah.
They're lines. They're lines that were very deliberately drawn
artificially,
to divide people. Uh-huh.
The same thing with I'm against flags, for example. Yeah, flags is just something to say we are different than you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. No. It's the ruling class is incapable of solving the fundamental social problems that exist facing people. But
do they even want?
No. The one thing they're very good at, well, there was a time when capitalism was progressive, right? And as brutal as they were, the robber barons, we called them the robber barons, as brutal as they were, they still had a vision. All right, I want to build railroads so that we have modern cities. And of course, they were brutal, anti-immigrant, bloody things, but they had this vision of creating something.
A better future.
The pharaohs created architecture that's better than anything we have today, right? Today's ruling class only knows how to steal. They produce nothing.
Yeah, there's no legacy. Well, the legacy that they have is what we have right now. You know, this disaster that we are living right now.
Yeah, and even that, they don't preserve. So every new building that goes up is worse than the last. All they can see is how do we steal Social Security? How do we steal, you know, whatever is out there? You know, and that's all it is. You merge companies, you merge unions, they're just so blind with greed that they can't even take a longer range vision.
Yes, how to erase a new right that was, you know, for the workers.
Just look what last night had, what's going on with Texas now.
Yeah.
I mean, and these politicians, they're not stupid. They just think, oh, we can just, the employers, by getting rid of, by driving down the rights of people of color, by not letting black people vote, by getting rid of women's rights through right to reproduce and all this stuff, we will make more money. That's all it is.
And the status quo is going to be to their favor, and the patriarchy is just going to
well until there's a new explosion of social movements, which I believe there will be. I'm older and wiser than you in this sense, Guido, because I'm an older man than you are. But no, I mean, I've seen it because I lived in the 50s and 60s and saw what happened in the 70s and 80s. And everything became transformed because you had a youth radicalization. You know, yeah. Well, you saw that.
The power is pendular. That has been always the case. So,
well, people are going to rise up because it's going to keep getting worse until people rise up. I mean, people I don't think are going to go voluntarily to species extinction. There will be a fight. People will fight to keep alive their children, to keep alive the world as it is, what they can do to change it. And you see periodic uprisings, you know, Black Lives Matter, Occupy, mm-hmm. these things. At some point, that will become more generalized. And we see that happening in South America and Central America.
Yeah, well, the case of Chile, yeah. I mean, 2 years ago, it has been amazing. You know, the case of Colombia, the same thing.
Yeah.
So there are movements that are not dead. The pandemic came in a moment that it was very convenient for the power.
Yeah.
And but those movements are there. So.
And those movements, you know, that's what impelled, that was a big part of the, you know, what impelled the movement in the United States in the 60s too, because we related very much. We were against the war in Vietnam, but we related tremendously to what was going on in the revolutionary movements mm-hmm. in Latin America. I mean, I used to dress up like Che Guevara here down the
middle. I also see those pictures. You must have some.
I got arrested. I was at Kent State University when the shootings took place, and I got arrested, and I had a big Che stencil on a red jacket on my back. And the cop had a gun to my head, and vigilante actually had a gun to my head. And I forget what I told them.
Yeah, and because you mentioned Kent University, and you were part of that, and I didn't want, but now I think it's important to ask you, how effective do you think repression is?
Well, I think you have to take into account the relationship of class forces. I became involved in the anti-war movement in the late 60s, when it was still could be maybe a minority movement. When my first demonstration I organized in high school in 1968, and we got beat up, and we were considered a minority. By the time the shootings took place at Kent, we were becoming a majority movement. After the shootings at Kent, the invasion of Cambodia, the shootings at Kent, it was clear because we had reached into the army, and it was a majority movement against the war in Vietnam. And when the shootings took place, what Nixon and the ruling class hoped would do, and they did the same thing in Mexico with the protesters mm-hmm. Earlier, much worse bloodshed in Mexico, where they hoped. It's the arrogance of power. They think, well, we'll shoot people and that will scare them and they'll go home. But that's not what happened. They misjudged that. Instead, there was a national student strike, which remains one of the largest political and the most sustained political demonstration, because it went on for a long time in the United States. Millions of students went out on strike. Over 400 campuses were occupied and students began to run the universities. That was an amazing moment in history. And out of that came, out of the anti-war movement came the women's movement, the gay liberation movement, the ecology movement, all these social movements. So there was that big explosion. And they've never been able to turn that around. You know, the ruling class is trying very hard. Like this thing in Texas, for example, they'll pass these laws. They can pass a law against to further restrict voters, and they can pass a law to restrict women's rights. But that hasn't changed the consciousness of women. Women still believe they have a right to choose their own bodies. And Black people think they still have a right to vote. So it's not like we're going back to the 1950s, which was the last real conservative period in the United States that I remember. And they trying to do this, to get back to where we started, with the cult, this idea of culture wars. They're trying to, the culture, what this thing they bring up about the culture wars every once in a while, what they're trying to do is they're trying to suppress the progressive ideas that came out of the social movements of the 70s. And so the idea, for example, that you're supposed to teach Black history, you know, oh, well, you're being politically correct. Well, yeah, there was a Black history and you suppressed it for centuries.
That is political.
Yes. And we are no longer willing to accept this. And today, because I'm old enough to remember when, before there were Black studies programs, before there were women's studies programs, I remember as we published Malcolm X's speeches, I remember going and getting a new speech by Malcolm X and going, oh my God, this guy, he's amazing. And then a couple of weeks in a socialist newspaper. And then in a couple of weeks, you'd get another. I would go to the Greyhound bus station and I'd get a new speech by Che Guevara. None of this was available. There were no speeches by women. There was no knowledge of the women artists, of the earlier waves of the feminist movement. Nobody knew who Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was and these great agitators that came out of the labor movement. So we were just, you know, this was all coming because out of the social struggles. And they want to put that back in the box, but the genie's out and it ain't going back. So they can try to make inroads, and they have made some minor inroads, I think, in terms of the abortion stuff. You know, people are a little less inclined to be open about that. But that's really been the default of the women's organizations, like now the National Organization of Women and the NAACP and these traditional groups. And of course, at the heart of it is the lethargy of the labor officials who are just sitting like lumps while the species is being threatened.
Well, the unions.
The union officials. The union members would be okay, except we have very conservative union officials. I mean, they're just comatose. I mean, you don't even see them. It's unthinkable, and I can't think of any other country of the world where these kind of major assaults would be taking place against the working class, where there wouldn't be some kind of official act, even if it was meant to demobilize, even if it was really just that, we're just going along with this. But in the US, nothing.
But we seem to be in a very lethargic.
So sorry.
We seem to be in a very lethargic time. I mean, the information is there. I mean, we are more informed than ever, but there is no response from the people.
Well, the American workers are further to the left, in my opinion, than ever before. But the thing it's hard to remember in the United States, because we look at what the U.S. does, we see them bombing in Afghanistan, we see them bombing in Iraq, we see them doing drone attack places. And we think, oh, the might of the US is directed against these peoples of the world. And that's true. But actually, much more of it is directed at us, but it's through our heads. Everything, the media, the arts, the education, the church, from the day you're born in the United States, you come to the United States, you are special. You're an American. You're this, you're that. And this stuff, and vote. If you vote, that means you're free. You got the little purple thing on your finger. That is everything. It's the official religion of the country. So we are subject to the mental weapons, to the psychological warfare, unrelenting from day one. And it immobilizes and divides people. And that is the biggest weapon they have. Steve Biko said the greatest weapon in the mind of in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Steve Biko, the South African freedom fighter. And that is so true.
Fear
of each other, you know, divisions among each other, any trick in the book. It's the one thing the ruling class in this country, they're so good at. Any little thing that happens, any disaster, they get people fighting about it, you know. Down to the shop floor, I worked as a machinist at one point in my life, you know, and they get these people on this part of the shop floor to be against those people. So you get some Eastern European workers here, and you get them divided against Southeast Asian workers over
because
here.
They are better on that, or they are better on the other.
Everyone divided.
Kind of reason, yeah. Yes.
And of course, a lot of the work that I do is designed to try to overcome that. What is an American? There's no such thing. You're a worker.
Yeah.
You're a worker. You work. You sell your labor power. She's a worker. She's a broadcast worker.
Are not at 1%.
You're an educator, you know. I'm a retired worker now, but you know, I was a railroad worker, whatever. We're all workers. That's what we have in common, you know. And what does it mean to be an American? The only time you're an American is when they want you to go die somewhere, fight and die somewhere. Then you're an American. Or when you're paying taxes.
Oh, that's for sure.
You know, that's then you're an American. But really, what is this status coming out of the womb within a certain borderline, or getting a paper that says, you know, we have to stop thinking we're workers, we're Americans. Americans, I have that big banner upstairs, Malcolm X, who says, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, I don't consider myself an American. I'm the victim of Americanism. And that's what we all are. We're a victim of Americanism.
Mike.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Going back to censorship.
I can easily digress, you know.
I see. I want to listen to your opinion about the destruction of this public art, number one. And second, what would you say to the anti-racist movement activists topping Confederate monuments? And we, even here in London, we have the case of Columbus. It was taken out and putting a shelter or something like that. So those uncomfortable monuments that are a statement itself, and I think that nobody can say the opposite. What is your opinion of that?
Well, it gets complicated. And the reason it gets complicated is because in reality, working people have no control over the production of culture in this country. We're consumers of culture. And one of the things about artists, and you know this as well as I, is we fight to be able to make art. Most of our artist's life is spent trying to make art, struggling to make art, which is a basic human need. It's just like we would fight to breathe, we fight to make art. All of us, not just people who call themselves artists. So, and there's no way to resolve this. And culture is part of this mental weapon that is used against us. So the art that we're given, the movies that we watch and all this stuff is designed to make us react to certain ways. And if you're good at it, you can make a lot of money. Steven Spielberg can make a movie about World War II that seems like it's anti-war, but in the end, you see you're waving a little flag. And he's very good at that, and he becomes a millionaire. Now, I make anti-war films.
But you cannot sell your art the same way that he can.
No, they're not going to offer me any money to paint a mural because I'm going to name the people responsible for sending our children to their deaths, and they don't like that. Now, when the thing with the that came with the Confederate statues came out of the Black Lives Matter and the whole issue of the brutal ongoing lynching and death machine that's set against the Black community
that is still
intact and has existed since the importation of Africans forcibly into the United States. You basically had slavery in different forms. And whereas they used to have mass spectacles of lynchings, they can no longer get away with that because of the civil rights movement. So now you have police executions. And it instills fear that African Americans are supposed to act a certain way. They have to, you know, you have to do things a certain way. And it's designed to make people malleable.
The spectacle is still there.
Yes, it is. But now we have demonstrations and stuff. And that is the only thing that will tie the hands of these people. When they see thousands of people in the streets protesting and doing these things. And as part of that, people react to these symbols of white supremacy. And the statues, the Confederate statues, were very consciously done as part of the Jim Crow movement, as part of establishing and suppressing rights that had been won during radical Reconstruction after the Civil War movement. Okay. And so, you know, there's an initial thing where, you know, I have to admit, as someone who's been frequently censored, even I'm looking at this and I'm going, oh, I'm glad to see that happen. I'm glad these people are angry and tearing it down. And that was began as a spontaneous thing. Now, what happens is it then becomes, unfortunately, kind of an official, a political strategy of what I would call some ultra-lefts. Some, you know, people will sometimes self-dial themselves as anarchists or ultra-left. Like, we're going to go down and knock this statue down.
Yeah, also, I was going to ask, and that goes to the other question that I was going to ask you, which is about cancel culture.
Yeah, well, yes, and while I support all actions against all anti-racist actions, I think it's very unwise and misguided. And the main problem with things like, well, there's a number of problems with this, but the main one is that it makes working people spectators instead of participants.
Yeah, we are the spectators.
Yeah, we're supposed to sit and applaud. No, we need movements. We need people in the streets demanding. There's a difference between marching and demanding that you have a different kind of culture, different kind of
having a like in your Facebook, which is what we do right now.
Yes,
we think that we are doing our part, but signing a document or doing a like to whatever posting.
It's not really doing anything. And there's a certain logic that comes. Then people say, well, why don't we get rid of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson? You see. Now, if you get rid of Thomas Jefferson, the logic of that, unfortunately, is you go in and you empty the museums. Because what's in our museums? It's all the history of the ruling class that denigrates people of color, that denigrates women, shows them as possessions. So once you start down that road, then you have a big problem. And I thought the way the Cubans handled the example of Columbus, for example, was a much better way than saying we should take down statues of Columbus, which is what happened in New London here. The Cubans say, no, you can't do that. Yes, Columbus was evil because his system was evil. And it represented, and here's what happened. But here's what else happened. You had this encounter between Europe and the indigenous people. And that's why you have tomatoes in Italy. And that's why we grow these vegetables different places. And that's why we learned how to make tools. So you can't just look at it. You can't replace one simplistic narrative of history. Columbus discovered America and there were natives there and he brought civilization with another simplistic narrative of history that this is just evil and it would have been better if the Columbus said no. There were already people dying from academics. If we have to learn from these things, we have to learn, we have to embrace our history. We have to look at it with its warts. And the main thing is art should be pedagogical and it should not be destroying a statue of Columbus is not how you engage with anti-racist activity. That does nothing to advance the struggle.
Learning the history and not editing it.
Yes.
But we have a history that has been always edited.
Yes.
And now, what do you think, just to wrapping up, about, for example, AMLO, the president of Mexico, asking the crown of Spain to apologize for the colonization of America?
These things are, you know, these are political theatrics, right? I mean, really, and of course, in Mexico, politicians are very good at this, good at these things. But, you know, it's like, okay, well, who are the Mexicans? Well, the Mexicans are of Spanish heritage. They're of the indigenous heritage. Yeah. You know, I mean, at this point, the whole world is melting. You know, it's all, everybody's everywhere. And, you know, when they talk about, when I want to get to cancel culture in our last couple minutes, because this idea of cancel culture, if you want to talk about cancel culture, you really have to talk about the working class being canceled from culture. And I happen to be a good example of that. It's not just that I'm censored. I am canceled.
You're erased from history.
Erased. I do not get invited to have exhibitions. I do not, am not invited to be a visiting artist. I hold the title of the most censored artist in the world, probably, right? And yet, you would think that of the tens of thousands of visiting artist lectures every year, I'd get invited to one. Never one. Never an inch in an art journal. Nothing. You'd completely canceled. Just like the Mexican immigrant who maintains the safe food products and grows our food. They're totally canceled. Where are the people who grow our food? Why isn't there a TV show about them? Why aren't they on the radio? Why don't we hear the story of their lives? What could be more dramatic than mass migration of human beings to come and feed us, right? To catch our fish, to create clothing for us to wear. And yet they're
because we also don't want to see that. We are so brainwashed that we don't want to see that.
We don't. We live in little bubbles. They put us in little bubbles. They put us in little bubbles. And they allow us to choose a certain model of bubble in the way we get to choose a certain model of automobile. But really, they're all pretty much the same. Right. You can be a broadcaster in Brooklyn and live in a certain neighborhood there and adopt a certain lifestyle. Or you can be over in Queens in the university there. Or I can be up here painting a couple of murals or whatever. And I wear black and you wear one thing and somebody wears grunge and then you can be kind of a hipster or whatever. These are the little choices they let us make. These are the choices they permit us to make. But all of us are discouraged from really doing the kind of work that can advance us collectively, that can make us think and act collectively. It's all designed to atomize us. It's all designed, and they're very good at that.
Yeah. However, we are the humans, the species as a species, we survive because we collaborate with each other.
Yes. Yes. That is why I'm very confident about a lot of things. I'm really confident about young people today, who, because all the obstacles that they place, people are very good at figuring out ways around it. They really are. And I think it's going to be an amazing social struggle unfolding, which I probably won't be around to see. But the stakes today are so much greater than they were in the 70s or the 1930s, periods of intense labor unrest and stuff. But really, the stake of the species is the stake
it's
of
in danger.
Is And so there's these formidable stakes, and a huge battle is going to unfold. And young people today are much more worldly in their outlook, and they are much cleverer about finding ways to work together. And and I think I was teaching street art and mural painting, only courses in the country when I started them. And yet in street art, you see every night, and it's an amazing thing to think about, every night, tens of thousands of young people around the world, in every country, every city, go out in defiance of the authorities to make art. You know, they face arrest, they face death.
But they believe what they were doing, and they believe that it was important, and they were changing the world with that.
And it comes from the heart.
Yeah.
It just we are herd animals. We are social beings. We are social beings. For us, making art is as important as breathing. It really is. And so we're going to do it. We're going to do it. We're going to find a way to do it. Right, Zenon?
Okay, Mike. I think that we have to finish this conversation. So I want to say that I'm so happy that we had this talk, that I love you and I admire you very much. That
you're
you
the
are
man.
My role model in many, many, many different levels.
Well,
and I have to say that publicly now.
I'm so much older and wiser than you are, Guido. That's all. You have youthful enthusiasm. You know you are an amazing artist, and you have to follow the direction of your art. Guido makes very, very beautiful. Very beautiful pieces of work. Very different. I could not do what he does.
You're my friend and you love me. That's why you're saying
that. I love you very much.
I love you too. And
what he does is amazing. There's no right way to make art. I do agitprop art. That's what I do. And that's right for me because of where I come from and whatever. But there's no right and wrong way to make art. There's just art. You have to follow the direction of your art.
Totally.
And I've noticed the direction you're going in your art. It's a little middle class crisis going on there,
sure.
Guido.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's great. Thank you. Are you happy, Zena? Are we done? Did you wrap it up?
It was a lot. I don't know how we did with timing, but I think very, very bad.
I go off on tangents.